ॐ असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। त्वमेव माता च पिता त्वमेव त्वमेव बन्धुश्च सखा त्वमेव त्वमेव विद्या द्रविणं त्वमेव त्वमेव सर्वं मम देवदेव। गुरुर्ब्रह्मा गुरुर्विष्णुः गुरुर्देवो महेश्वरः गुरुस्साक्षात् परब्रह्म तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। कस्तूरितिलकम् ललाटपटले वक्षस्थले कौस्तुभम् नासाग्रे वरमौक्तिकम् करतले वेणुः करे कङ्कणम् सर्वाङ्गे हरिचन्दनम् सुललितम् कण्ठे च मुक्तावली गोपस्त्रीपरिवेष्टितो विजयते गोपालचूडामणिः। अस्ति स्वस्तरुणी कराग्रविगलत् कल्पप्रसूनाप्लुतम् वस्तु प्रस्तुत वेणुनादलहरी निर्वाणनिर्व्याकुलम् स्रस्तस्रस्तनिबद्ध नीविविलसत् गोपीसहस्रावृतम् हस्तन्यस्तन तापवर्गम् अखिलोदारम् किशोराकृति। नमस्ते एवरीवन्। टुडे इज़ द फोर्थ डे ऑफ दिस भागवत सप्ताहम् एंड आई वुड लाइक टू थैंक श्री प्रवीण फॉर यू नो कीपिंग हिज हाउस एज द वेन्यू फॉर दिस फोर्थ इवेंट। थैंक्स अ लॉट एंड वंस अगेन थैंक्स टू श्री बिजू नायर फॉर सेटिंग अप दिस इनिशिएटिव। वेरी वंडरफुल एंड कार्लसरुहे इज स्पेशल फॉर मी बिकॉज इट इज हियर इन कार्लसरुहे अबाउट 8-9 मंथ्स बैक दैट आई हैड द अपॉर्चुनिटी टू टॉक अबाउट भागवतम फॉर द वेरी फर्स्ट टाइम। Okay, so talking about Bhagavatam in Karlsruhe is therefore special. Yeah? So thank you. So today we plan to read Ambarisha Charitram, and Ambarisha Charitram being a relatively small episode in Bhagavatam, we'll have some more time left over. So I plan to cover Jadabharata story also in the remaining time. So you could take Jadabharata story as the bonus for today. And so we'll start with Ambarisha story first. Now Ambarisha is one of the ancestors of Lord Rama. Ambarisha is a king whose name appears in Valmiki Ramayanam. You know, in Valmiki Ramayanam, when Rama and Sita get married, at the marriage, you know, there is a tradition to talk about the parampara in which the bridegroom comes and the parampara of the bride. So both sides have a purohit and they both talk about the father, grandfather, great-grandfather and all that. Nowadays, we only talk about three generations. If you observe the Vivaha Mantra, the boy is introduced as somebody's son, somebody's grandson, and somebody's great-grandson. So the three generations, father's grandfather and great-grandfather, father's names are introduced. In Rama's case, he was so special, Vasishta started the narration of his parampara right from Ikshvaku. Ikshvaku is the first king in that list who is the son of Lord Surya. And Lord Surya, so that entire Vamsha, Rama Vamsha, it is Surya Vamsha. Just like the Pandavas Vamsha is Chandra Vamsha, Rama's Vamsha is Surya Vamsha. So their forefathers are supposed to be descendants of King Lord Sun, Sun God. So in that list of parampara, some 125 kings are mentioned in Valmiki Ramayanam, and Ambarisha comes in between. So Ambarisha is a very special person, and here we have a very short introduction to Ambarisha himself. So Ambarisha's grandfather is called Nabhaka. Nabhaga, not Nabhaka, Nabhaga. And Nabhaga's son is Nabhaga. Okay, and there is a small story about Nabhaga and what happened during Ambarisha's childhood. So, not Ambarisha's childhood, Nabhaga's childhood. So, apparently Nabhaga had four or five other sons. And Nabhaga was probably the youngest. So, he was still a brahmachari and he was in Gurukulam, still learning under the Guru. At that time, the division of the property had already happened between the brothers. And the brothers were so smart that they didn't leave anything for Nabhaga. So, they left him out of the equation and they divided all the property among themselves. And then Nabhaga comes from Gurukulam and sees that there is nothing left for him. So he goes and asks his brother, where is my share? And the brothers give a very smart answer, your father is your share. You go and ask your father. Then Nabhaga is kind of perplexed. He goes and asks his father, what is this happening? So Nabhaga says, no, your brothers are kidding. Father cannot be your share. But there is some problem. Okay, anyway, I'll give you a solution. He said there are some rishis belonging to Angirasa Gotra. Okay, so that's all incidental fact. It's not very important for the story. So there is a group of rishis performing a particular yaga which is going to take place for 12 days. And those people are going to have some difficulty on the 6th day because they are not going to know the Vishwadeva mantra or something like that. So he says, you go to that yaga and you chant that two suktams on the 6th day. And then when the rishis finish the yaga and go to heaven, whatever is left of the yaga, they will give it to you. You manage with that. So that is the solution the father gives. And then Nabhaga very sincerely goes to that yaga. And as predicted, on the 6th day, the rishis have a problem with the mantra on that Vaishwadeva suktam or whatever. And this Nabhaga completes the yagam, because if you don't chant a particular mantra, the yaga becomes incomplete. Then there is a dosham. So the rishis are thankful to Nabhaga because he rescues their yajna by chanting that appropriate suktam. And so at the end of the 12th day, when the yagam is over and the rishis, as a benefit of that yagam, they ascend to heaven. So, as they go, they leave whatever is left of the materials of the yaga, they leave it to this Nabhaga and they go. But then, a black Brahmin from the northern side comes and claims that very same set of materials. He says, this belongs to me. And apparently that black Brahmin is none other than Rudra. And Rudra is a devata guarding the northern part of the direction. And Nabhaga says, no, but the rishis told me that I will be, able to take ownership of the material. He says, no, this is actually my share. Whatever is left after the yaga, I am supposed to take care. So how can you claim? Then he says, okay, you go and ask your father. Your father, whatever he says, we will abide by. So the father is now the mediator, this Nabhaga. And then Nabhaga goes to Nabhaga and asks, what is this? You told I will get the share of the yaga, but somebody else is claiming, what should I do? Then he remembers, okay, this person who has come to you is Rudra, and what he says is correct. it actually belongs to him. So you go and tell him, this is actually your share, but can you please give it to me? You go and ask him. So Nabhaga goes back to that black Brahmin and he says, yes, my father told this belongs to you, but can you please help me with this, you know, wealth, whatever is there. Okay. Now this Rudra is then pleased. He says, okay, I am very happy. Your father was impartial. He did not deliver a biased verdict. He delivered a clean verdict based on the law. And you also told me very honestly whatever your father told. You didn't lie to me. So I am very happy with your truthfulness. So I will teach you the highest of the knowledge. So he teaches what is called Brahma Vidya. And in our Shastras, the Brahma Vidya, which is the, you know, the truth about God, the true nature of God, that is supposed to be the most supreme of all the knowledge. And so that Brahma Vidya, this Nabhaga acquires from Rudra himself. Okay. So this story, what we should understand is that this King Ambarisha, about whom we are going to now read, he doesn't come from Aisavesa family. You know, he's not from some any ordinary family. He is coming from a family of very gifted and very knowledgeable, very, even knowledgeable is not the right word. They are very, you know, sacred family who have Brahma Vidya, that kind of knowledge. So Ambarisha is a descendant of that kind of a king, that kind of a family. So about that Ambarisha, we are going to study now. And the portion where we start knowing about Ambarisha is very brief. He says that Ambarisha is a Mahabhagavata. That is the first sentence about Ambarisha. And what Bhagavata means, that he is a Paramabhakta, he is a great devotee of the Lord, of Lord Narayana. And the word Bhagavata is a very special word which is used to mention about devotees of Narayana. You know, the devotees of Devi or devotees of Ishvara don't get that word Bhagavata. So the word Bhagavata is a very special word that is used for denoting Lord Vishnu's Bhakta. So he is a very devout Narayana Bhakta and he is also a Jnani. So he is a very knowledgeable person. And so this story occurs as a part of another story where, you know, Parikshit is listening to Bhagavatam from the Rishi Shuka. So at this point, Shuka and Parikshit have a short conversation. So Parikshit wants to know, tell me more about Ambarisha. You say that he was able to, you know, get over Brahmana Shapam. You know, Brahmana Shapam is a curse of a Brahmana. If you rub the Brahmana on the wrong side, then the Brahmana can get very angry and curse you. And that can lead you into a lot of, you know, big trouble. So you tell me that, you know, Ambarisha had withstood a Brahmana's curse. So tell me what did he do? So with that introduction, the story starts. Okay. So Ambarisha apparently was ruling over the whole earth. Because here it says, he was ruling over the earth with seven islands. And the seven islands are basically what we would call the seven continents. Go Asia, Europe and all that. You know, all these were referred to as Saptadvipa. So in the Sanskrit mantras, whenever we talk about the Bhumi itself, there is an adjective Saptadvipi. So Saptadvipi means consisting of seven islands, seven big islands. Okay, so he was practically ruling over the whole world. And he had a lot of wealth, obviously, because if you are ruling over the whole world wealth is yours. But he did not have any attachment to that wealth. So he was so wise that he knew that any amount of wealth is perishable. So he, at his mind, at his mental level, he had nothing, no attachment to his wealth, even though he was ruling over the whole world. He had no attachment personally. So he was a viraga purusha. He was full of vairagyam. And you know, in vairagyam, I think in Malayalam, the word vairagyam has a very different meaning. In Sanskrit, the word vairagyam means you are detached. You are completely detached and you just deal with whatever you are dealing with at a very transactional level. You don't really, you know, invest a lot of emotion in whatever you have. That is vairagyam. So he is a viragi, vairagya purusha. And so he would only do what is good for the people. And you know, he was a very righteous king. He was following dharma, and all his actions were devoted to the welfare of the citizen. And the rest of his time, he was doing a lot of devotional work. So he would take care of temples, and he would take care of puja and puja related activities. And so he would, it says here that he would use his sense organs only for those activities which were connected to God. You know, some examples are given. So he would use his eyes only to look at the murti of the Lord in the temple. So his eyes were used only for that purpose. Okay. And his nose he would use primarily to enjoy the smell of tulasi, which is the prasadam coming from the Lord. Okay. And he would use his taste, organ of taste, the tongue, only to, consume the prasadam coming from the puja. Okay, so what it means is, the way he uses his sense organs was very balanced and just to the purpose. He was not indulging in sense pleasures. He was not spending his time and energy in pursuing sense pleasures. That's the meaning. Okay, so, and he started doing a lot of yagas. And as a part of these yagas, he started doing what is called a Dwadashi Vratam. Okay, and the Dwadashi Vratam is mentioned here that, Dwadashi is actually the 12th day from the new moon day and 12th day from the full moon day. So in every month, you get two Dwadashis. The day after Amavasya is Prathama, Dvitiya, Tritiya. So these are all numbers in Sanskrit. So up to Chaturdashi you come. Chaturdashi is the 14th day. And then after Chaturdashi, you have Purnami, which is the full moon day. And then after full moon day, again Prathama Dvitiya start. So like that, every month you have two Ekadashis, two Dwadashis, two Dashamis. Okay? And the Ekadashi day is very special for Lord Vishnu. And this Dwadashi Upavasam or Dwadashi Vratam that he was maintaining, it consisted of eating only once on Dashami day, that is, the day before Ekadashi, he will eat only one meal. And on the Ekadashi day, he'll have complete upavasa. He'll skip complete food. And on the Dwadashi day, the next day, he will eat only once. Just once to break the fast. So that was the Dwadashi Vratam that this Ambarisha was doing. And he did it for one full year. One full year he did. That means probably every month he did it twice. Because in every month you have two Ekadashis and two Dwadashis, so he probably did it 24, 25 times in that particular year. And when that particular 1 year cycle was about to be completed, on that last day, the Rishi Durvasa arrives in that place. Okay, now Rishi Durvasa is a very special character. No? He is a very learned Rishi, he is a very powerful Rishi, but he also has a very negative side about him, that he is very short-tempered. And at the touch of a button, he can give you a curse. And his curses will be, extraordinarily powerful. And even ordinary rishis may give the normal curses, which will, somehow you can manage. This man's curses can be deadly. It's like atom bomb. Okay, so this Durvasa arrives on that last Vratam day. And, he wants to be part of the breaking of the fast. Ritual, on Dwadashi day when you break the vratam and eat the food, that's called paranam. And that's the special, meal that you have because you have just finished having a vratam and you're supposed to consume that Dwadashi paranam as a prasadam and you are fulfilling your, that 24-hour complete fast or whatever. So, our Durvasa wants to be part of that. But then he says, let me go to the river nearby, let me have my snanam and let me complete my nityakarma and then let me come back. And he goes off. And Durvasa, he doesn't come alone. He's got some 1,000 shishyas. So whenever Durvasa comes, he comes with 1,000 shishyas. That means you got to feed 1,001 people. Okay. So this Durvasa, he just goes and he's having a gala time in the river. Maybe he's having a great bath and doing a lot of. No, he forgets that he is committed to Durva, Ambarisha, that he will come. and he is just there in the river, not bothering that the time is running. And the problem with this Dwadashi Vratam is that when the Ekadashi ends and Dwadashi begins, you are supposed to break your fast and eat. That Paranam has to be done at the time Ekadashi Tithi ends and Dwadashi Tithi begins. And so Ambarisha waits. Ambarisha doesn't want to, you know, miss the Dwadashi Tithi. So he waits for a long time. And then he sees that time is running out. And he has to finish the fast and he has to eat before Dwadashi runs out. Otherwise, his vratam is of no use. Because, you know, he has done this for the whole full year. And this is the last vratam. And if he doesn't do it properly, then the whole, the benefit of this entire 1 year will be gone. So he's also worried. So he's in a dilemma. So he cannot eat because Durvasa is supposed to come as his guest. And he should eat because the vratam otherwise will get damaged. So he is in a dilemma. And then he has his own advisors. And finally, they all consult and they decide that taking a sip of water is equivalent of breaking the fast. But it is also not actually eating. So it's a kind of compromise. So just to make sure that the vratam is not, you know, injured or damaged or, you know, in danger, and not to insult Durvasa because he is a guest. So he has to eat only when Durvasa comes, but he cannot wait until Dwadashi Tithi goes. So he, as a compromise to finish the vratam, he takes a small sip of water with a small tulasi leaf in it, and then with that he finishes his Dwadashi vratam. And then after some time, our friend Durvasa comes there, and he learns that Ambarisha has actually broken the fast, and he runs into a terrible rage. You know, like usual, he loses his temper and he is all anger, and he says, "Oh, you have insulted me! I am a great Brahmin, I am a great Rishi, and you know all the shastras, and how dare you do this? Let me see how you can escape this." And then he says, he plucks a hair out of his head and then throws it to the ground, and from that comes out a very fierce demon. A fierce Rakshasa comes out of it. And he commands that Rakshasa to go and attack Ambarisha. Okay? Now, we have to go a little flashback. Ambarisha, being such a great devotee of Lord Vishnu has been so happy with Ambarisha that he keeps his Sudarshana Chakra in his custody. So Ambarisha's puja ghar, that the place where he has his worship, among all the other murtis, he also has Sudarshana Chakra sitting there. Okay, so Sudarshana Chakra, which is Lord Vishnu's weapon, is in Ambarisha's custody. And when this Rakshasa starts trying to attack Ambarisha, Sudarshana Chakra comes alive and kills this Rakshasa. So instead of, you know, Ambarisha is very composed. He says, "Okay, I have not done anything wrong. If the Rakshasa is going to kill me, let the Rakshasa kill me." So he is not lifting a finger. But to protect this Ambarisha, who is such a dharmavan, the Sudarshana Chakra emerges from the puja room, and then that Sudarshana Chakra kills this Rakshasa, who has been, you know, driven by Durvasa to attack Ambarisha. And then with that it doesn't stop. The Chakra then starts chasing Durvasa himself. So because Durvasa dared to, you know, insult a bhakta, a true bhakta, for no fault of his, so the Sudarshana Chakra wants to punish Durvasa, and it starts chasing Durvasa. And so Durvasa runs all over the world trying to avoid the Sudarshana Chakra, and he's not able to, you know, escape. Then he rushes all the way to Brahmaloka, where Brahmaji is sitting. And he falls at Brahmaji's feet and say, "Hey, please protect me from the Sudarshana Chakra. You know, it is chasing me all over the world." So Brahmaji says, "No, I can't do anything about it. You got into trouble with Ambarisha, so this is Lord Vishnu's chakra. I have no powers to manage anything of that. So please don't put me into trouble. If you come and, you know, take custody in me, I'll also be in trouble with you. So you better leave my place." So he chases this Durvasa off. Then what can Durvasa do? He thinks, and then he rushes to Kailasa. He rushes to Kailasa and goes to Lord Shiva and falls at his feet. Lord Shiva also gives him a piece of his mind and says, "This is not my business. You started this. You better handle it at your level. This is Lord Vishnu's chakra. I can't mess with it. So you are free to go anywhere you want." Then finally, our Durvasa rushes to Vaikuntha and falls at Lord Vishnu's feet itself. He says, this is your chakra, please control it. He is chasing me. Lord Vishnu says, you know, you took Ambarisha to task for no fault of his. And I am actually under the control of my bhakta. And Ambarisha is my bhakta, so I cannot do anything that, you know, that can overrule Ambarisha. So you better go and fall at Ambarisha's feet itself. He is the best guy to protect you. I cannot do anything. So Vishnu also washes his hands off. So Durvasa has no other choice. He goes all the way back to Ambarisha's palace and then falls at Ambarisha's feet and says, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done this. I am at fault. I shouldn't have done this. Please excuse me. Please save me from this chakra. Then Ambarisha takes, pity on this Durvasa. And then he chants about 12 shlokas praising Sudarshana. You know, that is Ambarisha Krita Sudarshana Stuti. It's a very beautiful portion in Bhagavatam again. Like I said in the other case also, one can use the Ambarisha Krita Sudarshana Stuti as a prayer. Yeah, this is in 9th Skanda, right? Yeah. 9th Skanda, 4th chapter. Yeah, it's a very beautiful set of shlokas, not more than 10 or 12 shlokas. And it can be used as prayer. You know, it runs like Tvam Agni Bhagavan Suryah Tvam Somo Jyotisham Patihi Tvam Apas Tvam Kshitir Vyoma Vayur Matrendriyanicha Sudarshana Namastubhyam Sahasrarachyuta Priya Sarvatra Ghatin Vipraya Swasti Bhuya Idaspate Tvam Dharmas Tvam Ritam Satyam Tvam Yajnokhila Yajnabhuk Tvam Lokapala Sarvatma Tvam Tejaha Paurusham Param. Like that, he's got some 11 shlokas. So it is basically, it is praising Lord Sudarshana as none other than Narayana himself. You know, there is a Sudarshana Sahasranamam, and if you read the Sudarshana Sahasranamam, it has about 128 or 129 shlokas. About half of the namas of Lord Sudarshana are nothing but borrowed from Vishnu Sahasranamam. There is a 50% overlap between Vishnu Sahasranamam and Sudarshana Sahasranamam, which tells you that Sudarshana is none other than Lord Vishnu. Okay, so in these 11 shlokas that Ambarisha chants, pleasing Lord Sudarshana, he is praising Lord Sudarshana as Vishnu himself, not different from Vishnu. And he says, you know, this man is a learned man. He did this, out of a fit of anger or whatever. He must have done it out of ignorance. Please excuse him. Don't, trouble him. Leave him alone. So that is the end of the shloka. And with that, Sudarshana also cools down. And he goes back into the puja ghar of Ambarisha. You know, when this whole thing is happening, it is not just Sudarshana is chasing Durvasa. When Sudarshana is chasing Durvasa, Durvasa is actually burning. He is feeling the heat. Because Lord Sudarshana is also a form of Agni. And so the temperature of Sudarshana is on Durvasa and he is actually burning. So the slokam says Jwara. Vijo Bhavatu Vijwaraha. That is the word he used. So he says, stop heating Durvasa. So cool him down. So with that prayer, Sudarshana withdraws the heat from Durvasa, and then Durvasa becomes normal, and then he blesses Ambarisha with lot of wealth and fame and all that, and then he eats the Dwadashi Paranam, and then he walks off. So this is the story of Ambarisha. Now after that, Ambarisha continues to rule the country for a long time, and finally he gets good gati, moksha and all that. So all that is incidental to the story. But the main part here is that Ambarisha is a great bhakta. He was a very righteous king. He did not do anything wrong in having that sip of water. But for no fault of his, he got into trouble with Durvasa. And even though Durvasa is a very powerful rishi, his shabam could not do anything to Ambarisha because he had the complete protection of Lord Vishnu. Okay, so the lesson to be drawn is from both sides. You know, on the one side, if we are doing our duty, our bhakti properly without breaking any rules, we can be 100% sure that we will not fall into trouble. Like Ambarisha was protected, the Lord will protect us. So that is one message. And the other message is, however scholarly a person may be, he should not pick up unnecessary quarrel with another righteous person, because it can boomerang on him. So the lesson is for somebody like Durvasa also. The moral is for somebody like Ambarisha also, who is a very devout person and who is following all dharmas. And if you are following your duty properly, if you are following the rules, and if you are if you don't do anything wrong, a temporary problem should not affect you. So you could get into some temporary issues, like Durvasa's shapam was a temporary problem for Ambarisha, but it's a temporary problem which he got over. So you need to have that kind of a faith and confidence that the Lord will protect you no matter what your troubles may be. So that is the lesson we have to take home. Yeah. So with that, the Ambarisha story is over, actually speaking. So the Ambarisha story is just about two chapters in the whole Bhagavatam, and two fairly small chapters. Okay, so we have a lot more time left. I think we have something like 90 minutes. You know? So I thought I'll take the available time to talk about another good story, which is called the story of Jadabharata. Okay, now the story of Jadabharata comes in the fifth skandam. The story of Ambarisha comes in the ninth skandam. Ambarisha's story comes in the ninth skandam, which is the fourth and fifth chapter. Okay. Ninth skandam, fourth and fifth chapter is Ambarisha's story. And Jadabharata's story comes in the fifth skandam, beginning from the seventh chapter. It runs from 7th, 8th, all the way to 12th chapter, if I'm right, or even 13th. It's a fairly long chapter, but the story part is not that long. Sorry? Fifth skanda. Actually, it goes all the way to 15th chapter, but the story part is confined to 7, 8, and perhaps 9. So I'll stick to the story, because Bharata teaches the Brahma Vidya to another king, and that portion is a very elaborate portion, and it's also a fairly abstract portion, and that may not be of interest to a lot of people. So we'll stick to the story part. Okay. Now, Bharata. Now, there's a short introduction about Bharata. So he is straight away introduced as Bharata himself. We don't have much information about the ancestors of Bharata. Okay. Now there is another Bharata who is mentioned in another Puranam, who's the son of Dushyanta. Now there is a king Dushyant, and he marries Shakuntala, and Shakuntala is the daughter of Vishwamitra. And what is not very clear is whether this Bharata and that Bharata are the same, because in this seventh chapter it says that the territory that we know today as Bharat or India, it started being called Bharatavarsham or Bharatavarsham after he became the king. Okay, this Bharata. Okay, so it says, and before that apparently our territory used to be called Ajanabha. Okay, it's called Ajanabha, and only when this Bharata became the king, it started being called Bharatavarsha. Okay, but what I have read is that king, who is the son of Dushyanta, son of Shakuntala, is also attributed the same credit, that because of him only the country started being called Bharatavarsha. Okay, so whatever it is, it's incidental. So he is introduced straight away as a king, and also he is a Mahabhakta, Mahabhagavata. Okay, and so he had something like five sons. So his sons' names are given. Once the first son was Sumati, then Rashtrabhruta, Sudarshana, Acharanam, Acharanan, then Dhumraketu. Okay. Then he ruled for a very long time, and he ruled in a very righteous manner, adhering to all the dharmic principles. He performed a lot of yajnas, and then he was a very strong Narayana Bhakta. And at some point, after he has ruled for a very long time, he divided the kingdom to all his five sons, made them responsible for certain parts, and then he went to some place in the Himalayas. From the description that you see, it looks like it is in Nepal, because it says he went to a place where the river Kentucky was flowing. And Kentucky or Gandaki is a river that we all know is in Nepal. And it also says that this river had a lot of Saligrama. And today we know that the Gandaki river is where the Saligramas are got. You know, Saligrama is a stone that you pick up from the Gandaki river, and we worship the Saligrama as Vishnu itself. So many people will have in their house at least two or three Saligramas, and they treat the Saligrama stone as Lord Vishnu himself. Just like you have a Shivalinga in the form of Shiva, no, you treat a Shivalinga as Shiva, you treat Saligrama as Vishnu. Okay, so he goes, and he first goes to the ashrama of a rishi called Pulaka. So he goes and he learns the shastras. You know, when you take sannyasa, you are supposed to go to a rishi and learn shastras from a rishi. So he goes to the ashrama of Pulaka and learns the shastras for a long time. And there he follows the dharma of what is called vanaprastha. Because when you are a king, when you are ruling, you are still a grihastha. You are in charge of the society, you are in charge of the family, you have responsibilities. And then when you abdicate all that and go to the forest, you enter the vanaprastha ashrama. And for the vanaprastha ashrama also, there are a lot of do's and don'ts, regulations. So he was following all of that. And as a part of that vanaprastha dharma, you are supposed to do a lot of puja and lot of dhyanam. You're supposed to meditate for a good part of the day. You're supposed to reduce your food intake and, be thinking only about the Lord and, divine thoughts and all those things. So controlling your sense organs and, spend your time with bhakti and so on. That he was doing. He was doing it for quite a long time. But then one day what happens? He is at the riverfront, taking bath and doing his Nitya Karma and all that. At that time, a deer comes. A deer which is nearly pregnant, almost about to deliver a baby, full pregnancy, and this deer comes and it wants to drink some water from the river. But around that time, a lion is roaring. And a lion is somewhere in the vicinity. That this lion roars and this lion wants to come and attack this deer. So the deer is terrified. And so the deer wants to escape from the lion. And out of fear, it jumps across the river. So maybe the river was narrow at that point or whatever. So it takes a certain effort and jumps from one bank of the river to the other bank of the river. And in that jumping effort, it ends up delivering the baby itself. And this newborn cub or calf, the deer calf, falls into the water. And the deer goes to the other side of the bank, but the calf falls into the water. And this Bharata Rishi, he is looking at this and he takes pity on that calf which falls into the forest, into the water, because apparently after jumping to the other side, that mother deer also dies. So the deer is not alive. So at least if the deer was alive, he could have just joined the baby with the mother and they could have, survived later. But because of that effort of jumping the river, the mother deer dies and the baby is left with Bharata. So out of pity for this deer cub, this just newly born cub, he takes it to the ashrama and he starts caring for this deer. And slowly what happens, all his thoughts and attention and energy is slowly, diverted from the puja and upasana and dhyanam and all that. And slowly his time starts more and more, getting devoted to the care of this deer, the deer cub. So at one point, even in the middle of the puja, he is suddenly distracted by the thoughts about the deer. And if the deer happens to go out somewhere from the ashrama and it doesn't come back in time, then he is worried about the safety of the deer. And sometimes he has to go to the river, you know, to pick some water or for whatever. He will then carry the deer also with him, because if the deer is kept alone in the ashrama, it may be attacked by some wolf or some other animal. So he wants to protect the deer from all dangers. So like that, what happened? No, he was a king. He is a very learned king and he knows all the shastras. And he came to the forest in order to devote time for bhakti and dhyanam. But because of this deer entering his life, he loses track and he completely starts, thinking about this deer all the time. All his waking hours, all his sleeping hours, he becomes so obsessed. And he doesn't realize that he has slipped from his, Vanaprastha Dharma, and so he is obsessed. And one day he dies. This Bharata Rishi dies eventually. And at the time of death also, he is worried about the safety of the deer. Wow, who will take care of my deer? You know, it's a very innocent creature. You know, it has been so affectionate to me all these years. What will it do without me? So those kind of ideas are occupying the Bharata's mind. And with this thought, he leaves the body. And as I said yesterday, the last thought that you have at the time of your death, it has a definite influence on your next birth. So the next birth, he is born as a deer. This Bharata, this Rishi, who is such a learned man, he is born as a deer in the next Janma. And even though he is born as a deer in the next Janma, because of his previous birth, having been a Rishi and having been a learned person, that Vasana continues in the deer's body. So, in the deer's body, he is now thinking about, why did I do that in my past Janma? I was so foolish that, I got distracted by a deer. I should have stuck to my Vanaprastha Dharma and all that. And he is regretting. In the deer's body, this Bharata's soul is now regretting all that had happened in the later part of his life. And so this deer decides to spend time, at least in this Janma, let me be near the Rishis and all that. So it goes to some ashrama nearby where some Rishis are, discussing Shastras and Veda and Upanishads and all that. And it tries to spend its time near that Rishi's ashrama, and it tries to follow whatever the Vanaprastha ashrama was supposed to be doing, eating only dried leaves, One of the dharmas of the Vanaprasthas is to avoid eating rich food and eat only dried leaves and dried grass and all that. So in the deer body, this Bharata now starts eating the dry green. Normally the deer would like to eat fresh, lush green grass. Okay. Now this deer is avoiding all the green and lush grass, and it is eating only the dried grass and dried leaves and all that. It is trying to live as though it is living in a Vanaprastha situation. And in that life, it spends some time, and then finally, it leaves that body also. So the second Janma of Bharata is also over. From the deer body, he now is born into a Brahmin family, the third Janma. Okay. Now in the third Janma Brahmin family, his father had two wives, and the first wife had some four or five sons, and they were all being trained in the Vedic training. They were being taught the Vedas, and they were being taught all the Karmakanda and all that. And this Bharata's third life, he comes as the son of the second wife, and they have a son and a daughter. Now, the first wife's sons don't think this guy is a bright fellow. They have a very poor opinion about Bharata. They don't know his previous Janma. They don't know that he was a jnani, and they don't know any of that. So, Bharata, what happens is, because of his past experience from the Bharata Janma and deer Janma, he has become a jnani, more or less. He realizes that this world is perishable. This world is not real, and all the material wealth and all that, all the material wealth, fame, position, all these are nothing. It is Paramatma, it is the Ishvara, God, who is the ultimate savior. So he is in a kind of what do you call, in Sanskrit there is a word called Unmatta. Unmatta means a lunatic. He appears to be a lunatic, but he is not a lunatic. He is doing that because he doesn't have interest in anything. You know, if you give him food, he will eat. If you don't give him food, he will go without food for several days. Okay? He will not care about the cleanliness of this clothes. So he will go around with unwashed clothes. So because his thoughts are not in this world. His thoughts are in the divine space. And so he doesn't care about all this Veda mantras and all. So in the Bhagavatam it says that his father tried teaching him Vedas. And he would not pay attention to the teaching. And he would chant the mantras wrongly. He would chant the mantras without swara. And his father will get violent. He'll get wild. He will admonish him. He'll teach him two times, three times. Then he will hand over the son's responsibilities to the other four brothers from the first wife's son, and they would try to teach him, and then also he will not learn properly. Then they will finally give up on him. And so this fellow, even though he's a Brahmin and he's got a sacred thread and all that, by looking at him, you will not think he's a Brahmin. He will look more like a Shudra. Okay, like that he goes on. And then just to teach him some lesson, his brothers make him work in the field as a laborer. And this fellow will work. So he will do whatever the brothers tell him to do. He will not complain. He will not complain and he will not want anything also. So he was a kind of a very indifferent person. That's the word. He's completely indifferent to the world. And if something good happens, he doesn't smile. If something bad happens, he doesn't cry. So he is just like a, in Tamil we have a saying, he's got skin of buffalo. So he's completely insensitive to whatever happened. So he was like that. So he was completely insensitive. He would just be his own self and not care about anything. And slowly what happens, this boy is he's considered to be a write-off. His brothers decide this fellow is good for nothing and they completely ignore him. And so he is kind of moving around in the forest, and generally people think he is a madcap, you know. And one day what happens, one set of robbers, the robbers have their own tribal customs. And this particular tribe of robbers, they have to give bali once in 15 days or something. And so they were looking for an appropriate animal for giving bali. Bali means sacrifice, you cut. And they were actually going out, their chieftain had told them to go and look for an appropriate bull. And so they were roaming around at night looking, if there is a bull somewhere, which can be grabbed and taken for bali. And then they come and find that this fellow sitting in some field in the darkness. So they catch hold of Bharata and take him to the, bali place, the Kali temple. And they wash him and, they decorate him with flowers and all that, and they do puja. Because before you give somebody as a bali, you have to perform puja, make him eat properly and all that. So they give him all that respect and they prepare him for the bali. At that time, in Bhagavatam it says that the Kali for whom this bali was being prepared, she knew the greatness of this man. And she did not want such a great scholar to be given as bali. And so, in Bhagavatam it says, Kali herself comes out of the murti and she takes the sword with which he was supposed to be killed. And she kills off all the robbers and sets this Bharata free. Okay? So this happens. This is mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Okay? So that means, due to some divine grace, he escapes that danger. He should have been killed otherwise. So he escapes being a sacrificial goat. And Kali herself helps him escape. And then again he goes away somewhere. And there is a king who is a very learned king, and he wants to go to the ashrama of one Kapila Rishi for learning Vedanta. So he is actually coming on a palanquin. Palanquin is that dholak, dhola, no? So you have four or eight people carrying you are carried along. So that king is coming along that way, and one of their carriers is falling sick at that time. So they are short of one man. So the king tells his men to go look around and find if somebody can be brought as the substitute. because you need 8 people to carry the palanquin and one guy is fallen sick. So this king's servants, they catch hold of this Bharata and make him carry the palanquin. Okay, so this is where the story becomes interesting. So Bharata is a jnani, he's a scholar, he's a Brahmin by birth, he has the sacred thread and all that. But maybe it was night, maybe the servants didn't know that the sacred thread means a Brahmin or whatever. So in spite of being a Brahmin, this Jada Bharata, he gets the name Jada Bharata because he started behaving like an inert person. Jada means inert. And as I said, he was not very careful about his cloth. He didn't bother about food. He didn't bother about rain or sunshine or heat or whatever. So he was completely indifferent, so he was almost like a stone. So that's why he got the name Jada Bharata. So he was very, very much like a stone. So this Jada Bharata, he is now carrying the palanquin of the king. And he has some problem in his feet. So he is not able to walk in a smooth, uniform fashion. So he has a slightly ununiform gait. So he, because of him, the palanquin has a very jumpy motion. Instead of going straight and smooth, it has a very jumpy motion. Suddenly it goes up, suddenly it goes down. The king is disturbed. And the king shouts at the men carrying and says, why don't you people carry me properly? Why are you throwing me up and down like this? And then they answer that, we got a new guy to carry the palanquin. That guy has a problem. So it is because of him that you are having the problem. So don't blame us for that. And then the king and Bharata start having a conversation. So the king actually pokes fun at him and uses some very sarcastic word and calls him whatever abusive language the king is capable of using. He is abusing Bharata in all those choiceful words. But Bharata just keeps quiet. He doesn't reply anything. Because according to Bharata, all these are incidental. Okay, so I'll try to read that part literally and see if we can get some of the sarcasm of the king. Okay. This Bharata actually is a very hefty man. He's a very hefty man. He's a very strong man. And so the king actually says, you have been carrying this palanquin for a very long distance, which is not true because he just started. He just started maybe half an hour back or 1 hour back. So he says he's being very sarcastic. You have been carrying this palanquin for a very long time and you are also a very lean and weak person. Okay, so you don't have energy and you are as though like an old man. He's not old, he's actually very young. Yeah, so he's kind of, making fun of him. And so you are suffering from old age. So because of that only you are not able to carry the palanquin properly. So what can I do? This is what the king remarks. Okay, but then Bharata does not reply to that. Okay, he thinks, all these are, he is only talking about my body, whereas I am not my body, so why should I bother? So Bharata just dismisses that. Then the king is upset because the king expected a retort from Bharata, but Bharata was keeping quiet. So he says, are you insulting me by not replying? Okay, so the king doesn't leave him. Okay, so you are ignoring my words and you are continuing to act the way you are doing. So you are insulting me by doing that. Okay, so even though you are alive, you are as good as dead. The king tells Bharata. So even though you are alive, you are as good as dead. Okay, you are ignoring the orders of a king. Okay. So, just like the Lord Yama punishes the people, I am going to punish you. The king threatens Bharata. Okay. Only if I punish you, you will get your, senses. You will come to your senses. Okay. At that point, Bharata starts responding to the king. So, that triggers a reply from Bharata and he starts answering the king. I'll read that answer. Okay. So, he says, hey, learned king, whatever you said is correct. Okay? Whatever said is correct. So, really speaking, there is no such thing like load and there is no such thing like carrier. So this is all philosophy. Okay, he says, neither are you the load nor am I the carrier. Okay, so now this is at a philosophical level. And even the path on which we are walking is mithya. So he uses the word mithya. Mithya, I have to explain the word mithya. You know, mithya is something that does not have true existence, but which appears to exist. Now, this is a very simplest definition. If it is complicated, please excuse me. So it is an illusion. So in an illusion, you think something is there. But when you go and inquire into that illusion, you really think there is nothing behind it. It's an illusion. So that is mithya. And mithya is something which has no independent existence of its own, but borrows existence from another object. And we give two, three examples for mithya. You know, when you walk on a road on a hot day, you tend to see mirage water. You know, you think there is some water somewhere. But when you go nearby, there is no water. It is just hard ground. So, that water which appeared to have an existence, actually derived its existence from the sand or the hot road. So, that is one example. And the other example we give is, if you walk on the beach, you have these seashells. And in the midday sun, the seashell has a shine and very often it appears like silver coin. So, if you may think there is a silver coin in the sand and you may rush to go and pick it up, but the moment you pick it up, you see it is not silver but it is only a seashell. So these are all examples we give for mithya or illusion. Okay. So, here Bharata says, there is no road at all, this road itself is a mithya. Okay. Then, The really learned people don't talk about the individuals being fat or lean because they are not properties of the cells, they are properties of the body. Okay, so this is all very deeply embedded Panchakosha Viveka in Vedanta. You know, in Vedanta, when we talk about the individual, there is a section in Vedanta which analyzes who are you, what is your true nature. And there we divide our physical body into five layers and we say that we are none of these five layers and we are something beyond these five layers. And that section is called Panchakosha Viveka. This is not the place for teaching Panchakosha Viveka, but I am just giving you a kind of hint. So he says that, you know, being fat, being lean, you know, having diseases, having mental stress, having hunger, having thirst, you know, having anger, having ego, all these things belong to the different koshas. You know, being angry belongs to your mind. Being hungry or thirsty belongs to your pranamaya kosha. Being fat and lean belongs to your, annamaya kosha or the sthula shariram. So, I am neither of these. I am not my sthula shariram. I am not my sukshma shariram. I am not my even karana shariram. So none of these adjectives fit me. So I am the chaitanyam. I am the chaitanyam. I am the consciousness. That is the level he is talking. Okay. So with all these replies, the king realizes that this man is not an ordinary carrier. You know, he is not an ordinary laborer. He realizes that this is a very learned person. So he stops the palanquin. He gets down and then falls at Bharata's feet. He says, you know, I'm very sorry, I made you carry my palanquin. I know that you are not an ordinary person. Who are you? Please tell me. Are you that Rishi Kapila himself, you know, in whose search I am going? So, you know, you seem to be a very learned person. Please teach me. So, he falls at Bharata's feet and then Bharata starts teaching Brahmavidya to this king and that runs for about two chapters. Okay, that part is completely philosophy. So, that is probably not of interest, at least in this forum. And then what happens? He very elaborately talks about what is dharma, what is the samsara, how to become liberated, what are the different paths to, you know, become liberated, what is karma marga, what is bhakti marga, you know, all those things he explains. No, samsara marga itself runs to two chapters. That means he explains what is the samsara in two chapters. Then I'm not going into the details. He talks about what is suffering, why do we get into suffering, how to avoid suffering, you know, what is the role of desire in our suffering, all those things, you know, all those philosophical things come in those two chapters. And finally, the king accepts Bharata as his guru, and then, you know, he probably, you know, lets him off as a free man. And after some time, Bharata becomes a liberated person. He leaves his body and goes to Vaikuntha. So this is the Jada Bharata story. Okay. Now, the message that you can get in this entire Bharata story actually is the philosophy part that he teaches to the king. That is actually the crux of the whole Bharata story. The rest of it is more to tell you that even if you are a very devout bhakta with a lot of maturity, that you leave the kingdom and go to the forest, at any time you can get distracted by some worldly, you know, things, like he got attracted to a deer, and that can lead to a spiritual downfall. So when you are on the spiritual path, you have to be extremely careful not to let your mind lose focus even for a second. That 1 second of losing focus can lead to a very big fall spiritually. So one has to be very careful. You know, in Kathopanishad, there is a mantra which says, Kshurasya Dhara. You know, Kshurasya Dhara means, it is like walking on the edge of a sword. Kshuram means a sword. And imagine if you have to walk on the edge of the sword, on the lengthwise, you know. It is, you know, walking the path of dharma and jnanam is so difficult that it is like walking on the edge of a sword. So that much of care and caution one has to exercise, and that is the main takeaway we can all take from this story, that when we are in the bhakti marga and in the path of spiritual progress, we should not lose focus even for 1 second. We should be extremely careful and keep our mind focused. That is the Bharata story. Okay, any question? Any discussion? Anybody from conference? You have a question? Yeah.
You said that the beginning of the Upanyasa, that Bhagavatam is some term that refers to Narayana.
Bhagavata. So, Bhagavan refers to Narayana. No. See, Bhagavan, you know, if you read Bhagavatam or Vishnu Sahasranamam or even Bhagavad Gita, whenever Lord Krishna talks, it does not say Krishna Uvacha. It always says Bhagavan Uvacha. So the word Bhagavan is a word that is specifically used for Lord Narayana and Lord Krishna. And because this scripture, this story, this whole Bhagavatam story relates to Bhagavan, it is called Bhagavatam. Okay, the Bhagavatam gets the name because it is relating to Bhagavan. So the story that deals with Bhagavan is Bhagavatam. And a scholar who specializes in Bhagavatam is a Bhagavata. So it's all derived from one word to another. Okay, so a Bhagavata is one, you know, Bhagavatam is a neuter word in Sanskrit. And Bhagavataha, that is a masculine word. Bhagavataha is a masculine word. He is one who, you know, worships the Bhagavatam, and through the Bhagavatam, Bhagavan. So the Narayana Bhakta gets the name Bhagavataha. So whenever you find the word Parama Bhagavata in Bhagavatam or any other Purana, it means he is a great devotee of Lord Narayana. So, Devi Bhagavatam is that scripture or book which treats Devi as Bhagavan. So, there Devi is the protagonist, central character. And in Devi Bhagavatam, you will see Vishnu, Brahma, Shiva, all of them will worship Devi. So, as I said, you know, this I mentioned in the very first day, in Devi Bhagavatam, Devi represents infinity. And all Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, they all represent finite benefits. In Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Vishnu, Lord Krishna represents infinity. And all other Rudra, Vishnu, Rudra, Shiva, all the Brahma, Indra, they all represent finite benefits. So the common or the concurrent theme is that the infinity comprises of all finite objects. Infinity, even in mathematics, infinity comprises of all finite objects. So if you get infinity, you don't have to worry about the finite things, because that one infinity brings all the finite things with it. So Paramatma, infinity, is symbolized by Krishna in Bhagavatam, is symbolized by Devi in Devi Bhagavatam, is symbolized by Shiva in Shiva Puranam. Okay? Yeah. Nabhaga himself is a king. Nabhaga, Nabhaga, Ambarisha. Yeah, see, that you find in all these stories, the sons get a share of the kingdom. Okay, it is not that, you know, they all become kind of independent at some point. And then one person becomes more glorious and the other person becomes a little less glorious. Okay, so we really shouldn't go into the historicity of all these things, because they are all incidental to the story. No, on the very first day I said that all these stories, you have to take it as the carrier of some message. And once you get the message, you have to drop the story. You shouldn't go too deep into the story and ask questions, because the purpose of the story is not for the story itself. The purpose of the story is to deliver that message. And once that message is given to you, you take the message, drop the story. Sorry? Yeah. It's like, you know, you take a capsule. That outer covering of the capsule is just to deliver the medicine. Once it goes, the capsule outer thing dissolves. It's not the main purpose of you are taking the medicine. The main purpose is what is inside the capsule. So the stories are also like that. You have a question?
An animal is also ready to do any sort of penance.
Your question is not very clear. Can you come little forward, because I want the question to be recorded also.
You are talking about an animal is also ready to go into a holy path even by having dried leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the actual moral that was thought about?
No. See, we say something like vasana. You know, you have to understand what is vasana. In the Vedic system, Shastra, what we learn is that this body that we have is a temporary residence for the Atma. Okay? And this Atma travels from one body to another endlessly. And the period in which it resides in a given body is what is called one janma. Okay? So, even though this Atma might have resided in different bodies over different janmas, it carries the cumulative effect of the experiences of all these janmas. It doesn't carry the memories. It doesn't carry the individual memories of each janma, but it carries some kind of an imprint, which is called vasana in Sanskrit. And that vasana carries, continues to travel with you no matter which janma you go to. So in this case, what happened? The Bharata king had in fact done a lot of upasana and had in fact attained a lot of sattva guna. But because of some mistake towards the end of his life, he had to slip into an animal birth. But even though he physically was in an animal body, that sattva guna vasana that he carried from the previous janma was with him and was alive, and that helped him to behave differently from the other deers.
Okay, so because in some language, we say Vasana comes by birth. But now I understand that not just by birth, you can also get it from your deer.
No, Vasana comes only from all your cumulative previous Janma. That is Vasana. That is the definition of Vasana. You know, all the details of the previous Janmas are not carried forward. They are all erased off. But, you know, to give you an example, very crude example, very gross example, in the financial accounting world, you open a new book at the beginning of the financial year. Let's say your accounting year is January to December. You begin your accounting on day 1, January 1st, and then you write all the transactions. You know, you buy a lot of items, you sell a lot of items, you incur a lot of expenses. All these transactions, you write in the P&L account or in some ledger. But at the end of the year, when you do the P&L account and balance sheet, you only transfer the balance, closing balance to the next year. You don't carry all the transactions the next year. The transactions are closed in 1 year and kept aside. Okay, so your Janma is like your operating account, like we said yesterday. So all the transactions that you do during the Janma are like the transactions of your P&L account. But you don't carry it forward to the next Janma, you carry only the closing balance. So whatever conclusions you draw in terms of your emotional maturity, in terms of your intellectual capability, your intellectual evolution level, all those things you carry. But the memories, individual memories you drop, you will not remember what you went through in the previous Janma. No, that's for your own good. In fact, in the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Lord says that I am memory and forgetfulness. And he says forgetfulness is a blessing. Because if you remember all the torture that you went through all the last 1,000 Janmas, you won't be able to sleep at night. So it is good that you forget a lot of what you underwent and you only carry the essence of whatever you learned, and that comes to you as Vasana. Any questions? Any more from the conference? Noah?
From the philosophy, what Jadaparada gives to the king is that much different from Bhagavad Gita, from the Karma Ganda, Jnana Ganda.
All the philosophies that you see in Bhagavatam and in Bhagavad Gita and in all the Upanishads, they are all consistent. There is no difference in what the Upanishads say and what Bhagavad Gita says and what the Bhagavatam says. People may interpret according to their, you know, school of thought, but the content is essentially consistent. Yeah? The real chemical is the same. The active ingredient is the same. Only the capsule in which it is contained could change. Sorry? Shape, even the taste may be different. Some of them are sugar-coated, some of them are not. But the message is the same. And that way, all our shastras are consistent. Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, all the 18 Puranas, Bhagavad Gita, any other Vedic scripture, all of them are consistent. In fact, in Brahma Sutra, there is a chapter called Samanvaya Adhyaya. And in the Samanvaya Adhyaya, Vyasa quotes mantras from various different Upanishads to show that all the Upanishads are consistent and there is no contradiction among the Upanishads. That is one of the central themes of Brahma Sutra. So Vyasa goes to very great pains to show that our scriptures are very consistent. There are no contradictions between the scriptures. Okay.
Thank you, Vasuji. I've got no questions.
Great. Okay, then we'll... Yeah, you have a question? Yeah.
Even a great Maharishi or someone who wants to be in the path of Vanaprastha has slipped because of a deer. Why should we call it a slipping? The deer came, but he didn't go in search of the deer. The deer came to him. So should we call it a slipping? should we not consider it as his destiny to safeguard the deer? Maybe it was not in his destiny to attain moksha in that birth. So my question is that we start calling even the Maharishi's past a split in their past, and we lesser mortals,
no. I get where you are coming from. See, the fact that Bharata rescued the deer was not the mistake. He was very, very correct in rescuing the deer. He should not have let the deer float with the water and die. After taking it to safety, at some point, he should have allowed the deer to be on its own. You know, in the Bhagavatam, I didn't go through the details. You know, in the Bhagavatam is a very graphic and juicy description of what all thoughts Bharata entertains regarding the deer. You know, at one point, he thinks that without him, the deer will not survive even for 1 minute. Okay. Now, the God's creation has its own way of functioning. And all the animals were not created with Jadabharata as their chief guardian. Okay. We all have a certain role at a certain point of time to take care of somebody or the other. But then, whoever we are guarding or protecting at this point of time are not going to be with us forever. So there is a time for us to be together and there is a time for us to separate. And that is called maturity, and Jadabharata lost that maturity by kind of arrogating to himself that without him the deer will perish. You know, the animals have their own way of surviving, and if Jadabharata had allowed the deer to be independent and freed it, then the deer would have survived and he could have happily gone to moksha. So the problem with Jadabharata was that he allowed his emotions to take over. And, you know, it clouded his judgment. It clouded his, conviction in the Dharma Shastra that, you know, after all, the God that gave birth to the calf would also take care of the deer. That is the maturity with which Bharata should have acted, which he didn't. For that, he paid the price by having to go through a couple of more janma.
This is also an example for the Vaidyas, the detachment,
yeah? So, you call it whatever you want. See, we all have... See, there is... in the Dharma Shastras, it's very clear that you all have a certain Swadharma. And that Swadharma, in ordinary parlance, you can, take it as the role that you are supposed to play at a certain time in life. Okay? So we all have to play a certain role at a certain time in life. And that role eventually comes to an end. When the role comes to an end, you have to accept that the role has come to an end and move on. And move on to the next role. You can't keep hanging on to the old role and, you spent a very beautiful 5-6 years with your kid. But then the kid grows. The kid becomes a 10-year-old, 15-year-old. Okay? And you can't, even when the kid is 15-year-old, you can't treat the kid as a 3-year-old because you love the 3-year-old kid. That's not Swadharma. You are willing to let go of an old role and you are not ready to latch on to a new role. So that is the difficulty that we all face, and that is a conflict that we have to resolve. Okay? Did I answer your question? I leave it to you. Okay. So if there are no questions, we'll close the session. No? Okay? Om Purnamadaha Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu. सर्वेषां शान्तिर्भवतु, सर्वेषां पूर्णं भवतु, सर्वेषां मङ्गलं भवतु। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।